happens to matter when you heat it to thousands of millions of degrees. You can't do that in a laboratory because you can't make a container that wouldn't evaporate at that temperature. So you have to turn to astronomy. So what we're doing in astronomy is trying to investigate the fundamental properties of matter, trying to understand more about the fundamental properties of matter in conditions that we cannot reproduce in the laboratory, and on scales, of course, of time and mass and distance and speed and so on, that are quite out of the reach of our earthly abilities and concepts. We're talking about masses of hundreds of thousands of millions times that of the Sun. We're talking about distances that take light thousands of millions of years to cover at 300,000 kilometers per second. So we're talking about vast scales, and of course we are curious to understand the origin and evolution of the universe because we want to know about the world we live in.
But down to Earth, great concepts must have small beginnings. The Royal Observatory's attack on the concepts is three-pronged.
Revival of optical astronomy, classical optical astronomy in Edinburgh.
Computer to sort out the data. The beginning here was to design the...
It's being discussed here.
...telescope to be based in Australia. It has been described to me as a huge but essentially simple camera with a lot of very complicated goodies tacked on the end.
Well, we had a proposal jointly between the UK and Australia at that time for building a large telescope in Australia, really to collect light from individual objects and to analyse it in great detail. We
extended to new wavelengths.
However,
recognition of new wavelengths.
Able to analyse light from very faint objects, and we didn't know the positions of very faint objects in the southern sky because nobody had ever to such faint limits. So we had to build some kind of giant camera. A survey of this kind had been done in the northern hemisphere at Mount Palomar 25 years previously. We decided that with 25 years of technology under our belt since then, we ought to be able to design and build a better and more effective telescope. We had a great deal of help from them, I must say. We built a telescope that's able to penetrate some two or three times further into the universe than the previous telescope in the northern hemisphere. So we have the most powerful telescope of its kind in the world there.
Two or three times?
Yes.
In terms of space, this is a considerable advance, surely.
It's a factor of 10 in volume, of course. It's an enormous difference because the effects that one's looking for at great distances in space begin to occur very rapidly as you're getting near the sort of visible edge of the universe. So there's all the difference in the world between being halfway to the edge and being nine-tenths of the way to the edge. And that is the jump that we've really been able to take. And we believe that we are close to that point in space, in the universe, that distance in space and time, where we might be observing the beginnings of the formation of galaxies of stars, almost the origin of the universe as we know it itself.
And this is long before, perhaps, the generation of our own planetary system.
Oh yes, long before. We've certainly penetrated back in time to long before our own solar system, planetary system was formed.
If you find that hard to focus on, it's just that light does take time to travel. That faint and distant object at some time burst into life. Its glow has travelled perhaps across much of the depth of the universe, and it has taken perhaps much of the life of the universe to arrive with us as a speck on a photographic plate. If it was, say, a galaxy, it may well have lived and burned out since, for all we know. Let's go back a mere 4 or 5 years in time and in space to Siding Spring, up in the mountains about 300 miles northeast of Sydney, Australia. It was about then the UK Schmidt telescope was going into commission, and Dr. Russell Cannon has managed the project since those early days. With some pretty startling form behind it by now, how can we begin to assess its value as an instrument?
Well, it's absolutely fundamental to quite a lot of research because its basic job is to take wide-angled photographs to find out what's there, what's in the sky, what kinds of stars and galaxies exist. Having taken these photographs, astronomers can then study them in detail and select the particular objects that they're really interested in, which they can then study in much greater detail using the other large telescopes like the Anglo-Australian telescope.
Now, in real terms, what have you personally got from the Schmidt so far?
Well, it's a bit hard to say. There's an overall satisfaction in getting the telescope working at its peak efficiency and in producing a sky atlas, which is going to be used by astronomers all over the world. But this is a fairly routine, mundane job, a lot of hard slog most of the time. There have been occasional highlights because we're seeing bits of the sky for the first time at the particular low light levels, and we're seeing very faint objects that have never been seen before. So every now and again we make a spectacular, unexpected discovery, like last year, a new dwarf galaxy in the constellation Carina, which is down in the southern hemisphere, which is a very insignificant galaxy, very small, but it's very near to us, to our own Milky Way galaxy. And this makes it an important discovery.
You've in fact picked up a whole galaxy, even though a small one, which was quite close to, and which no one had ever seen before.
Yes, yes, it's the sort of discovery that could only be made with this particular type of telescope.
The other great advantage is that you can look much more deeply into space, can you not, than might have been contemplated a year or two ago?
Yes, this is very much my own particular research interest, which I'm getting out of the telescope, is looking for these mysterious things called quasars.
Could we try and draw a picture of a quasar, or is this still something of an astronomical mystery itself?
It's very much an astronomical mystery. We don't really understand what quasars are or what makes them tick. It's a big problem. And one of the reasons it's a problem is because we still have a very small number of them. There are now a few hundred known quasars. What we can do with the Schmidt is find several hundred of these objects on one single photograph, so that with each photograph we take, we can obtain about as many quasars as were previously known altogether, discovered during the last 15 years.
But we're now thinking perhaps of objects in space which will throw a new kind of light on some aspects of astronomy, is that right?
Yes, we believe that these things are at enormous distances. They are the most distant objects in the universe that we can see, if we are interpreting them correctly. And on this assumption, they enable us to look at the very distant parts of the universe to see what the structure is. Is it just a great big uniform space, more or less the same everywhere as it is near us, or are there differences? And we're also, as well as looking at very large distances, of course, we're looking back enormous lengths of time to very early stages in the life of the universe. So at last we're beginning to get some real observational facts on what the universe is like at big distances and what it was like a long time ago.
And, of course, you have the Cosmos machine to help you interpret the pictures.
Well, this is going to be a crucial part. The Schmidt takes the photographs and obtains large samples of these things, but the problem is to find them on the photograph, and this is not trivial when you have a million objects on your plate, on your photograph. Which are the ones you want? You need an automatic machine to begin to do the searches for you.
So we enter a different kind of Cosmos. This one's smaller. It is, in fact, the second prong of the attack. It lives in the observatory building, and it's an advanced and rather idiosyncratic computer with an eye for scanning the skies.
Ralph Martin, what are we really looking at here? We've got these two glass plates. They're about a foot square or something like that. Pale grey, covered with speckles of all sorts of sizes, and these are stars which have been photographed, essentially.
Well, initially, with the plates which aren't so deep, that's basically all you can see, the stars. But on the deeper plates, if you look at them with a spyglass, you can see that there are lots of fuzzier objects than the stars, and these are the extragalactic objects of one sort or another.
And these would comprise a lot of stars, a lot of all sorts of planetary rubbish, shall we say.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. And what we have to make Cosmos do is measure these images as accurately as possible and put it out onto magnetic tape so that the astronomer can use the data in a quantitative manner.
In other words, the computer comes out with a string of figures which he can play about with.
That's correct.
But how does it actually work? I mean, you have, it's something like a television screen output with a scanner going to and fro and picking up all the signals from the stars, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's rather like a TV scan. It scans the plate in lanes and then turns that data using a special panel analyzer to the few parameters that the astronomer needs, like the area of the image, how black the blackest part of the image is, where the image is, and so on.
In other words, how big it is, so you can guess possibly how far away it is.
That kind of thing.
And we just heard the machine go. That was a scan just finished, wasn't
it? That was a lane of around 20 centimetres finished. So typically, it's measured, while we've just been talking, a couple of thousand images.
A couple of thousand stars, bits of galaxies, anything
yes.
you like.
Anything you like.
The Cosmos machine goes back to the same time that the Schmidt telescope was being designed and built. It's a very original and versatile piece of work, very much in demand by astronomers because it can handle all sorts of problems, apart from analysing the photo plates from Australia. It measures the coordinates, size, magnitude, orientation and shape of the images. Cosmos. It is a bit of a tall story, though. Well, Cosmos, like everything else on this circuit, is continually being improved, made to do bigger and better things. And Ralph Martin, who was talking in the machine room, looks after this side of the operation. I wondered, what were they scratching their heads about now?
Well, the immediate problem is to get the fine measurement mode working as well as we possibly can. The sort of problems that we're interested in solving with that is that we have done one experiment already with the parameter called Q0, which is essentially a measure of whether the university is open, closed, or infinite, or so on. And we achieved one result with the coarse measurement mode, but we'd really like to try and get the fine measurement mode going so we can repeat the experiment, but more accurately, because it didn't give us a definitive result originally, and maybe in the future with the fine measurement mode it might.
The Q0 parameter, it was put to me in the simplest terms as an astro-mathematical way of describing whether the universe might be flat or round, infinite or finite. We'll go back to it in a few minutes, but I should say that the Royal Observatory team are by no means alone in the hunt along this particular trail. Nevertheless, I take a bet the Edinburgh crew will be first home. But back to Siding Spring. Cosmos can sort out the pictures, but taking the pictures with modern high-technology telescopes is an art, or perhaps more precisely a science, on its own. Liz Sim qualifies, I think, as queen of the snapshots. She was 3 years working in the bush with the Schmidt, and in fact, she went in with the first wave.
Yes, that's right. I was one of the first people to arrive there, and a brand new telescope and a brand new site and all the brand new problems. And the first year was pretty rough because there were an awful lot of jobs to do and to unscramble, but the satisfaction came in the later years when we'd got the show properly on the road and were really beginning to see the potential of the equipment we had.
Well, I suppose, like all one-off jobs, in the first instance, nothing worked.
Well, a problem isn't a problem if you've anticipated it. And, of course, you always get caught out by the things you didn't expect, which is very worrying when you get a lot of these, but you have the satisfaction of getting rid of them eventually.
You were in particular concerned with souping up the photography, were you not?
Yes, we have always a problem doing photography in astronomy because the exposure times are so long. I mean, normally, if you're 35mm camera, you'll quite happily run at a fraction of a second, whereas we would normally be working at exposure times of an hour or more. So you've got a completely different brand of photographic plate, and you've got to treat them very differently. And to get the best out of the best available material, we finished up having to soak the plates in hydrogen for several hours before using them. But this meant that we were able to take plates in an hour, which went so much fainter than had ever been taken before, either in the north or the southern hemisphere. And when you can take a chunk of sky 6.5 degrees square at one go, I remember one of our distinguished research people who visited us took one look at that plate, a plate almost taken at random, not necessarily one of our best. And his immediate comment was, good heavens, there must be about 4 or 5 potential PhDs on one plate. Just to give some idea of the amount of information which we can collect in that time.
But with exposure times up to an hour, the telescope has to follow exactly the swing and tilt of the arc of sky as the night goes on, otherwise you get a blurred picture. Well, I shot this one at Dr. Andy Longmore, one of the astronomers on the crew, who had got back from Australia just about the day before I spoke to him.
Yes, that's quite correct. And this is why the old astronomers used to have to keep looking through the telescope. They would have a little hand, what's it called, a paddle, and do minor corrections to the telescope drive while keeping a star centred in a cross wire or some similar arrangement. And what happens now is this is all done electronically, so that there is an automatic feedback to the telescope drive from the automatic guiding mechanism, and we can just set the telescope up on a particular star, and it will follow that star until it sets, if necessary.
Once again, modern electronics, the thinking machine, is taking over and doing the job quite well.
It still needs somebody to design and build it.
Russ Cannon pointed out that there's a lot of sheer slog in routine observation. It's the occasional new discovery that really sets you up afresh. Andy Longworth's had one or two of these.
Oh yes, this has happened particularly in work with X-ray sources, which I've got quite an interest in myself. And it's extremely interesting to get a telegram from somebody who's working with an X-ray satellite, and they will give you perhaps quite a reasonable position for the object, but that may include many hundred or even sometimes thousands of stars, and there's no guarantee that there is even an optical object there that will show up on our photographs. So sometimes you can take a plate and examine it first thing the next morning as soon as it's been developed, and then it's very, very exciting to see this bright new star showing up on the plate where there's never been anything before, or where it was just at the limit of our detectability before.
This is a case of down to the store for a case of Foster's, I suppose, isn't it?
Oh, no, you get the results off first, and then you celebrate when you've finished that.
But with all the travel and the excitement of discovery, the stargazer's life is not always a jolly one.
If you take the personal view of the astronomer, one of his most difficult times is the night observing period, which sounds quite straightforward. A lot of people do night work in factories or things like that. But there is one difference with astronomy. You're very often at least working in parts of the building entirely on your own, and it's very surprising how you have to curb your imagination. You get funny noises in the night, and you can put up with this for an hour, 2 hours, but if you don't speak to anybody for in the winter nights, it can be up to 12 hours in the dark, mostly on your own. By the end of the 12 hours, as you get tighter and tighter, it becomes much more difficult to control your imagination.
It can be quite spooky, can't it?
It can be. There have been cases of astronomers that have had to go and have a rest for a while. It hasn't happened at the Schmidt, and I hope it doesn't. But in Australia, to take one funny incident, when I first arrived there, I was being shown how to use a telescope, and fortunately there were two of us there, and if this had happened to me on my own, it might have put me off observing for the rest of my time. But the person I was working with opened a shutter on one of the telescopes, and a huntsman spider dropped off the top of it down his neck. Now, if this had happened to me on my own in the dark, then that would have been much more unpleasant. It gave him a nasty shock as it was. When you consider that the size of these spiders is almost as large as your hand, then it is a bit of a shocking experience.
Well, I wonder what name they put to the new discovery that night. Now, the third prong of the Edinburgh adventure is pure technological buccaneering. The UK infrared telescope is big, it's new, and it's going to join a gaggle of others in Hawaii. No, not palm-fringed beaches and ukuleles. It'll be on the bleak summit of the old volcano Mauna Kea. And the infrared will be picking up what are almost heat sources, objects which are really scarcely visible at all. The mirror around which it's designed is about half the thickness of any previous mirror of that size, so thin it's almost floppy. It's propped up by electronically driven supports to keep it in shape while it roams around the sky. The whole structure is very much lighter, was built at about a fifth of the price and in half the time of anything similar. Dr. Terry Lee is at the moment on the mountain putting the thing together. He'll be taking over the operational team next year, and I talked to him just before he left.
It's going to be the largest infrared telescope in the world, and it'll be on the best site that we know of. Certainly it's the best accessible site.
It's got to be somewhere high where the air is very clear.
Yes, you need clear air and you need a very low water vapour content.
Oh, extremely dry air as well.
Very dry air, yeah.
And what kind of answers are you going to get out of this when you've got the thing going? What pictures is it going to give you?
Well, we can get pictures of the cooler regions of space. We can see things, if you like, that you don't see with visible light. And you can make maps of things which look really rather dull on a photograph of the sky, and pick up interesting bits of structure we can perhaps find temperatures, this kind of thing. We can look at regions of